All right. So before we get started talking about sankharas, we need to first kind of get on the same page about kama, which I talked about in the past, or in Sanskrit, it's karma. So kama is the Pali word for it, the language of the Buddha. So kama is, pretty straightforward. It's in the English dictionary. It's a pretty, it's part of our common vernacular. What goes around comes around. You reap what you sow, that sort of thing. Literally, it means action, and specifically how this action occurs. So cause and effect. And during the time of the Buddha, there were a number of ideas of kama, but they were all speculatively based, meaning that they were based on a sort of a notion of how the world works or a metaphysics. And in those ideas of kama, there wasn't really the notion of free will or responsibility, there was no freedom as a result. And so the Buddha took a different approach. And he said, instead, let's examine our own direct experience of reality and understand how kama unfolds based on that. So he focused on the mental processes of kama that you can directly experience for yourself. Specifically, the role of intentionality in the process of cause and effect. So, our focus tonight will be on the Buddha's idea of kama as intentional action. So, another waving of hands here. Who's familiar with sankharas? Has anyone heard that term before? Right. Okay, great. I'm glad so. Okay, so sankharas, which is in Sanskrit, it's samskara, is a, my perspective, a fundamental concept to understanding what's going on and what the Buddha was trying to teach. It is the second link in the cycle of dependent origination or dependent co-arising, and it is one of the five aggregates or the khandhas. So, what are sankharas? Well, literally, it translates to that which puts together. That which puts together. Common definitions are volitional formations. That's quite common. Ajahn Tanisaro refers to them as fabrications. Ajahn Suchito has calls them karmic blueprints. Guy Armstrong has sort of an interesting twist, I think, which is he calls it personality. So sankharas can be viewed from sort of in two ways. One is a passive sense, so as a noun, so a sankhara, which is one of the five is one of the five aggregates, and that's the notion of of conditioned phenomena, which is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and without a permanent self. So in Buddhist terminology, it has the characteristics or the marks of samsaric existence, meaning it has anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And in this passive sense, I actually like the what Ajahn Sanchitta came up with, which I love, which is Legos of the mind. So you can think of them as Legos of the mind in sort of the noun or passive sense. However, there's also an active sense of sankharas, sort of like the verb as a verb, as sankharain. So, and this is referring to sankhara's role as a process. As in the second chain in the cycle of dependent origination. So immediately after ignorance and delusion, boom, you have sankharas, which provides the foundation from where samsara starts. So, in this active sense, I have this notion, if it's a benefit, of that sankharas are kind of like overlays of understanding. So there's direct experience, and these sankharas kind of overlay that direct experience. And they become kind of the lens through which we experience and see that direct reality. So kamma, intentional action, operates through the means of sankharas. Or to flip it around, sankharas are the vehicle of kamma. It's how kamma plays out. So in my previous talks, I referred to the mind metaphorically as a vinyl record. Anyone remember vinyl records? Okay. So the mind spins around and around, playing our top 10 habitual thoughts or patterns. And these top 10 hits, they're being played by the record needle going around the grooves in the record of our mind. And because vinyl hadn't been invented when the Buddha was around, he used the metaphor of ruts in the muddy road created by the ox cart wheel. So in Buddhism, we call these ruts sankharas. So what's the big deal with sankharas? Well, these sankharas define us and our world because we start to identify with these grooves, these habitual patterns, and then we call the vinyl record the me album. And from that foundation, we develop a view, a karmic lens through which we see and interpret reality. Over time, this karmic lens gets thicker and thicker and thicker, layer upon layer upon layer. So here's my second metaphor after the record. This is the sankhara binoculars. So rather than a direct experience of reality, we're viewing ourselves and our world through increasingly distorted lens, through a increasingly distorted lens of sankharas. So, and this is where my notion of the overlay of understanding comes in. The thicker the binoculars, the greater the distortion, the more extreme our thoughts can get, because we're looking through the thickness of the binocular lens. And the more we incline towards sort of extreme or unwise attitudes and behavior. So internally, this leads to conflict if there's a difference between our worldview and the way things actually are. And that leads to suffering. I am this way. The world is this way, right? We cling to that view. That is the way it is, right? I am a solid person living in a solid world. That doesn't change. And if things don't go my way, I'm getting grumpy. So I start thinking things like, maybe I'm too tall. Maybe I'm too short. Maybe, let's see, I'm from a certain place. So that means, let's see, I'm a certain race. So that means I'm from a certain country. I have a certain skin color, so I'm this way or I'm that way, and whatever it may be. And externally, that also leads to conflict because if I'm this way and you're that way, then I, of course, must be right and you must be wrong, and or at best you're like different or weird or something. So people who dress a certain way must be like that. And those people who look a certain way must be like that. And those people who vote a certain way must be like that. Those people live over there, they're definitely like that. And of course, you know where that leads. Ajahn Suchito said, view is the instigator of karma. As you believe, so do you act. View is the instigator of karma. So you believe, so you act. So these sankharas define our experience of reality. In other words, our conditioning, our causes and conditions create the impression filters and form the mental and emotional lens through which we experience, interpret, and respond to reality. In fact, through which we actually create or fabricate ourselves and our reality, which is why sankharas are often referred to as fabrications. It's like a perpetual self-construction project. Another issue arises when we're on autopilot, because then the sankharas are driving the bus. Not necessarily bad or good, but because some of those sankharas may be wise and some may be not so wise, but ultimately they remain unexamined. And for most folks, they also remain typically subconscious or unconscious. And it's very hard for us to see past our own ingrained habits. We're stuck in our own habitual patterns of thinking, our cycle of karmic conditioning. And this is why psychology and meditation work so effectively together at this level, because they process, they are processes designed to uncover, expose, and disentangle us from our unhealthy underlying tendencies. And this is exactly what Carl Jung was pointing to when he said, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life, and you will call it fate. So how can we begin to break this cycle of karmic conditioning? How can we short circuit these sankharas, these habitual tendencies of mind? I don't know if anyone has any ideas, I think the answer is mindfulness. So mindfulness in the present moment. We can do this by slowing down the process through mindfulness or meditation in order to see more clearly the process that's occurring in the present moment, thereby exposing it, then beginning to understand it and respond mindfully and wisely when we encounter the freight train of past karma as it's coming down the tracks. And we can do this only in the present moment. So the freight train of past karma is coming down barreling down the tracks. But in the present moment, if we show up in the present moment, we actually have free will. We have the power to change, and we have the power to do the right thing. And in this way, we begin to uproot our karmic conditioning, so that we're no longer driven by these underlying and typically subconscious or unconscious tendencies. Otherwise, the old deep-rooted sankharas will still be in charge and will react to the same situation in the same old way as we always have. Now, at this point, I cannot overemphasize or overestimate the momentum of this freight train of past karma as it's coming down the track. So past karma is extremely powerful. It is a force But it is a force to overcome, and but it's you know, it's intense. It's strong. So you can think of things like addiction, generational abuse, deeply embedded cultural hatred, racism, sexism, on and on and on. That's why we need to chip away at it gradually, with patience and perseverance, with and by chipping away again and again, the karmic power of the habitual patterns begins to lessen and lessen. And as the karmic lens thins, it offers us an increasingly clearer and wiser and more direct experience of reality as it is. So another important aspect of sankharas is their habitual nature. As the Buddha said, whatever a monk keeps pursuing with his thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of his awareness. Whatever a monk keeps pursuing with his thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of his awareness. This is where the Buddha points to how we can strategically harness this understanding of their habitual nature, of how karma works through sankharas, to our benefit, to the benefit of ourselves and others. So on the one hand, yes, we can break down and deconstruct the karmic patterns that lead to negative behavior. But the Buddha also realized that on the other hand, we can also use the power of karma to generate positive karma. And in this way, it becomes an opportunity for skillful karma. In other words, acting with good intention leads to more beneficial outcomes for oneself and for the world. And furthermore, this allows us to take benefit of the compounding kind of snowball effect or ripple effect of karma to work in our favor. So meditation or mindfulness itself is a habit or a skillful means, as we refer to it in Buddhist circles, that itself can be cultivated, developed, and perfected, just like any other skill. And this is where the path out of suffering, out of dukkha, is strategic. It's about applying a skill, the skillful action of mindfulness and heedfulness. So, anyone recall the goal of the Buddhist path? Okay, well, I'll just toss it out here. So the Buddha said, I teach one thing and one thing only, the end of suffering. The end of dukkha. So suffering, or better translation, I would say, is unsatisfactoriness or stress, is the key metric here. So the Buddha applied this metric to karma. So, in other words, what kind of karma leads to more suffering, and what kind of karma leads to less suffering? So this is from the sorry, that's my computer sound. So this is from the Two Sorts of Thinking Sutta. Thus have I heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, in Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed the monks. Monks! Yes, Lord, the monks replied. The Blessed One said, Monks, before my self-awakening, when I was still just an unawakened bodhisattva, the thought occurred to me, why don't I keep dividing my thinking into two sorts? So I made thinking imbued with sensuality, thinking imbued with ill will, thinking imbued with harmfulness, one sort. And thinking imbued with renunciation, thinking imbued with non-ill will, and thinking imbued with harmlessness, another sort. And as I remained thus heedful, ardent, and resolute, thinking imbued with sensuality arose in me. I discerned that thinking imbued with sensuality has arisen in me, and that leads to my own affliction and to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding. And then the Buddha goes on, you know, as the suttas do, very repetitive. The Buddha goes on to repeat the same for ill will, thinking imbued with harmfulness, and of course the contrary for thinking imbued with renunciation, thinking imbued with non-will, and thinking imbued with harmlessness. So what is he saying? He's talking about the process of habituating wrong and right intention. It's like forming paths, neural pathways, as we say these days, in the brain, because neurons that fire together wire together. A famous neurophysiologist said that, Donald Hebb. And also, I do want to just emphasize here that, as kind of an aside, that when the Buddha is speaking of harmlessness here, he is not just referring to it being directed towards others, but also to ourselves. So bad or unwholesome karma based on greed, hatred, and delusion increases suffering. Good or wholesome karma based on generosity, kindness, and wisdom decreases suffering. And this is from Ajahn Tenisaro's, from the Dhammapada, some of the opening verses of the Dhammapada. So this is the Buddha. Phenomena, all sensory input are preceded by the heart or intention, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act in a corrupt with a corrupted heart, then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart follows the ox. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves. So this is empowering. In the conventional worldview, we do have free will, and therefore we have a responsibility to act ethically if we want to be of benefit, that the kind of benefit that leads to happiness and the end of dukkha. And this is why ethics, in Pali referred to it in sila, is so fundamental to the progress along the path. The Buddha used the common metaphor of cultivation to resonate with the folks in the agrarian society that he lived. So he talks about karmic conditioning bearing fruit or results. So plant and foster bad and unwholesome seeds leads to bad fruit and bad karma. Sorry, that's my my computer. All right, so plant and foster bad and unwholesome seeds leads to bad fruit and bad karma. Conversely, plant, water, and foster good and wholesome seeds leads to good fruit and good karma. And of course, we need honesty, integrity, and wisdom to be able to discern what's the most skillful and beneficial action to take. Sometimes it's very hard to see the role we play in our own suffering. And I can personally attest to that. We all have blind spots. And that's why, in addition to reflecting on our own actions and intention and the intentions behind those actions repeatedly, it's very wise to reach out to people you respect and trust to elicit their advice. And also to make sure that those people that you reach out to are genuinely wise and worthy of taking advice from. So throughout the suttas, there is a ubiquitous refrain about applying right effort. And it goes like this. Guard against the arising of unwholesome states that have not yet arisen. Abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. Develop the arising of wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And maintain wholesome states that have already arisen. So when we meet ourselves in the present moment, empowered with wisdom of how karma works, I would also add with empathy, patience, understanding, and ideally a little bit of humor, we can break free. Not easy, but doable. So remember the fourth noble truth. So what did it tell us? There is a way out. The Noble Eightfold Path is the fourth noble truth. It is the path leading to renouncement of craving and the cessation of dukkha. And what is the Eightfold Path? It is a comprehensive set of skillful means, or sankharas. The Noble Eightfold Path expands the practice from just meditation on the cushion to a full-time endeavor. It becomes a way of living. So at any time in meditation or in any situation, you need to ask yourself, what sankhara is running right now? Is it taking me into suffering and stress? Or is it leading me out of suffering and stress? So now we're going to shift gears a bit and talk about the comma that ends comma. So that we can, as the Buddha said, discern this penetrative holy life as the cessation of comma. In the Sutta Nipata, the Buddha said, whatever dukkha arises is all in consequence of the sankharas. By the destruction of the sankharas, there will be no origin of dukkha. Ajahn Analio in the Encyclopedia of Buddhism explains what the Buddha is saying here. This statement sums up the role of the sankharas as a decisive link in dependent origination of dukkha by declaring that all dukkha depends on the sankharas, and with the cessation of sankharas, no more dukkha will arise. Analia goes on to say, thus only nibbana goes beyond the range of sankharas, even in their most general sense, being in fact the stilling of all sankharas. In other words, the Buddha is telling us no more sankharas means no more kamma, which means no more suffering. And we win! So, here's the challenge. Because we exist in a causal system based on karma, intentional cause and effect is operating through the sankharas. We have to use karma, the power of the sankharas, to our advantage to escape karma by gradually short-circuiting the whole process. And this is where the wise strategic process of letting go comes into play. In the Wings of Awakening, a book that Ajahn Tinisaro wrote, he states, a way must be found out of the mechanism of karma by mastering it in a way that allows it to disband in an attentive state of non-intention. Ultimately, it's not about the content. It's about the disbanding, unraveling of this causal process of karma to attain freedom. In a way, it's depersonalizing karma. And in fact, it's actually a natural letting go process that plays out by itself, if we can only get out of the way. In Zen, it's described as wisdom, which is seeking for wisdom. That was Suzuki in Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I think another way of looking at it, though, is that it's simply opening to the emergence of the way things are, which is less of an objectification of a process that is ultimately non-personal, spontaneous, and non-referential. So we first must cultivate good karma, skillful karma. And then ultimately, we have to let go of even the Dhamma. And why is this? Because the Dhamma is a path. Talk about the Dharmic path, the path of Dhamma. Because it too is a sankhara. But fortunately, it's the karma that leads to the end of karma. But ultimately, at the final stages, that too must be let go of. So at this level of transcendent right view, we're in search of what the Buddha called karma that is neither dark nor bright, with neither dark nor bright result, leading to the end of karma. So eventually one stops supporting the notion that someone, a self, myself, is intending at all. Because that's actually just a notion, just another thought, just another sankhara. But let me be clear here. I want to kind of clearly delineate that I'm talking about, I'm talking about transcendence to the other shore at this point. So we're moving from conventional reality of what is real, as Ajahn Chah said, to what is true, to the absolute perspective or level of reality. So, and also, just as another aside, I want to say that, just to keep in mind that, as Ram Dass says, you still have to remember your social security number. If you walk into the street without looking, you might still get killed, whether you're awakened or not. So wisdom, we still need wisdom about how conventional reality works, which is what I've been talking about up until now, is still critical, even if you're awakened. But eventually the samsaric paradigm begins to unravel and fall apart by itself. So by being attentive to the process of sankhara-ing, instead of the content withheld within the sankhara, one will grow dispassionate and disenchanted with the futility of the endless, empty, impersonal drama, and stop feeding any sankharas anymore. Ajahn Santita said, "The karma that ends karma is based primarily in contemplative practice, in which we learn to see through the illusionary nature of concepts and views, and behold a world without presumption. To end formations, meaning sankharas, is to see all conceptualizations as empty and misleading." So again, Transcendence is to understand that at the conventional level, we have a fundamental misunderstanding. We think we are creating or performing these sankharas. But in fact, it's the other way around. These sankharas are creating us. Ajahn Suchito concluded, to put it simply, it's not so much that I create kama, but that kama creates me. He goes on, in brief, when you know how it works, and you have the skills and tools to deconstruct the programs of consciousness, the sankharas, you can stop doing samsara. So samsara is not a place. It's a habit. It's a sankhara. An unskillful sankhara that comes with a habitual perspective, a karmic lens, a way of understanding and perceiving that is ultimately based on ignorance, and that results in suffering, in dukkha. The mind or consciousness is just a process of reaching out for one sankhara after another. It's the monkey mind grasping for the next sankhara vine. Fortunately, the Buddha taught us that by understanding how the process of our collective reality works, we can deconstruct and stop samsara. What's operating here is not a you, not a me, but simply a set of sankharas playing themselves out. So at the ultimate level, there is no kama, because there is no intentional action, because no one is intending. And in realizing that, we let go of that notion of intending, because that is a delusion. That is the delusion. Freedom is realizing that there is no one to free. The Venerable Bodhisattva wrote in the Visuddhimagga, no doer is there who does the deed, nor is there one who feels the fruit. Constituent parts alone roll on. This indeed is right discernment. And this, of course, is the Buddhist concept of anatta, or not self. So it's all just one great big sankhara dance. But we weren't invited to the party. It's just sankharas dancing with themselves.